Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. Thank you so much for your amazing comments on all the episodes we've had this series, but I got a lot of response for last week's episode with Monty Don. A lot of you getting in touch to say you were basically just walking along the road crying. Sorry. I know I'm the show that does that to you, but yeah, thank you. I know it was it felt like quite a special episode, so thank you so much for getting in touch about that. If you are enjoying the show, please do rate and review and subscribe and that sort of thing. It does help make the show reach more people, which means I can carry on making them. Thank you if you've done that already. This week, I'm talking to former doctor and writer Simon Stevenson. Simon is the author of the brand new fiction work Set My Heart to Five, a very, very funny debut novel, which has come out now already, I think. He's also written for Pixar. He's written a film that's coming out soon, and you may have heard his name before because he wrote an award-winning non-fiction book, Let Not the Waves of the Sea, back in 2012. Let Not the Waves of the Sea was about the death of his brother in the Boxing Day tsunami, and that's the story we mainly spoke about. Do I have to call you Dr. Stevenson,
or
have you let that go?
No, absolutely not. I don't probably not even allowed to use that anymore. It's been a while. So.
Oh, really? Do you think there'll be like, yeah, as it comes a cutoff point, like you haven't like looked at a patient for a certain amount of time?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a legal one, but I think there's just a sort of like...
An ethical one.
An ethical one, almost like an embarrassment one that, you know, because of course, you know, if you say that, then I'm sure the next thing is someone will be asking for some medical assistance.
Oh, yeah, that's true, isn't it? Yeah. It's like when people find out, if you ever say you do comedy and they're like, oh, tell me a joke. And I'm sure if you ever said you're a doctor, they're like, oh, actually, I have this thing on my back. And you're like, I don't want to get into it, actually.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, Simon, who are we remembering today?
So my brother, Dominic, and also his girlfriend, Eileen, but obviously I'm mainly here to talk about Dominic. They were in the tsunami in Thailand in 2004, and they both died in the Boxing Day tsunami then.
2004, I'm still a bit staggered that it was 2004 because it's so fresh in my head. I mean, God, it must be for you as well. So what anniversary are you coming up to now that was 2004?
This will be the 16th. Wow. So it's Boxing Day. So it's always a sort of very easy day to remember.
Yeah, of course.
So the 16th. And of course, as you say, it doesn't really feel like that. I mean, in some ways, you know, it feels much shorter, and, you know, weirdly, in other ways, it feels much longer. You know, yeah. It feels like another lifetime ago.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Especially I find with this this century, because I think if you had a quite large chunk of your life in the other century, anything post 2000 is like, oh, that's quite new, right?
That's and the
I'm still
world.
Getting my yeah, that's like new, guys. And I'm still getting my head around, like, yeah, 2004 was 16 years ago. That is a long time, and so much has happened since then. Like, it's a bit bewildering, isn't it? So, your brother Dominic, And we should say, like, so you were very close in age.
Yeah, okay, he was, I think, 16 months older than me. Your mum had her hands full
when you were young.
She absolutely did, yes.
Yeah.
I think that was slightly more common then, right? I feel like, you know, growing up, yeah. we had lots of friends who were siblings with that 1 year, and now,
oh, really?
You know, most of my friends who have kids, you know, it's like often like a minimum of a 5 year gap before they're ready to take the plunge again.
So you were very, very close to him growing up, I'm guessing.
Yeah, he was always just, you know, he was always 1 year older, so he was always, you know, in that class directly above you, which I think for me was brilliant because, you know, you get all the advantages of, you know, having this person going through things slightly ahead of you, and also, you know, when he gets something, you can make a strong case that you're entitled to that thing as well, you know, if there's only a year between you.
Yeah, and I think, of course, and you can't have that because my brother's 4 years older, so there was always that argument of like, but he's so much older.
And you can't, like, that's irrefutable, right? That's that's a strong argument from the parents. But I think that the flip side is that, you know, it must have just been infinitely frustrating for my brother to finally get old enough to earn pocket money or do something by himself. And then it would probably last about 2 weeks before my nagging became incessant that, you know, I should also be entitled to this thing.
And do you have other siblings, or is it just the two of you?
It's just the two of us. And my parents divorced when I was about 12, and so I'm lucky to have four half siblings on the other side.
Right.
But in terms of, you know, growing up with my brother, that was yeah, he was a
okay. Year. So to go back to 2004, obviously, like, had he just gone to Thailand for holiday, or like, and it was all lovely and joyous? And
exactly that. It was so he and his girlfriend had been together for a year or two, and they had, my brother was an architect and he was 27, so as you probably know, it takes a long time to go through all that study. So he was kind of coming to the end of that, and he was working in his, you know, his first real job as an architect. They had just bought a flat in Edinburgh, you know, like the week before. And so, and they were going off for their Christmas holiday, and it was unusual. Like, you know, it wasn't something, you know, normally, you know, as a family, we're all in Edinburgh at Christmas, and this was kind of a different thing. But, you know, it just seemed like a great fun thing for the two of them to do. So, yeah, so off they went to Thailand, and they were about, I think, 4 or 5 days into their holiday. And it's really strange because the place they were was kind of one of the worst places to be in, you know, during the tsunami. And the idea that, you know, this is at most 1 in 1,000 year event, like, you know, in fact, probably way more than that. And then for them to be in that exact place for those 7 days was always a really just, frankly, strange thing to get my head around, you know, the chance and the combination of circumstances, you know, that took them there on that day, and, you know, they could have ended up at another place very easily.
God, yeah, it's really, so just, I mean, it makes me think about the 7/7 bombings.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I was like on the tube that day, and I had a friend of my, someone I knew from school, was dad was on the tube. And I remember us, but there was something about, you know, you're in London, we live in London. And even though you were like, God, they could have been on a different tube carriage in a different line, there was something like, oh, but it's not surprising they were in London. But for you, I guess that must be, like you said, so weird that they were just on the other side of the world at that point, at that beach, like all of those, there's so many things that had to happen for them to be there. Yeah, it must have been really hard after you found out that he was dead to kind of, yeah, just get your head around that.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's still, you know, to this day, it's still something, you know, that I think about. I mean, you know, a huge part of my grief journey, I'm sure we'll talk about it, was part of it was going to Thailand and being there where those things had happened and, you know, getting to know people. And then the other part was getting to know other families who had, you know, been through a similar thing.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, what you learn is, you know, that everyone has, you know, a version of that. And in fact, anyone who, you know, dies too young, there's usually some sort of, you could have taken a different bus, or, you know, and even illnesses, you know, there's just random luck involved, right? You know, and so, you know, is being on that beach any more unlucky than, you know, the people that get a really tough illness at that age? You know, probably not. And, you know, but it just felt like just so odd that they would be there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and to be so far away from you.
Yeah.
So how did you find out what happened?
Sure, yeah. So that was really a process. So I was at home in Edinburgh with my parents. So the tsunami happened at about 9 o'clock in the morning on Boxing Day in Thai time. And we are, I think the UK is 8 hours behind Thailand. So I was woken up by the phone ringing at about 9 o'clock in the morning, British time. And it seemed a bit odd. You know, I think it was actually 8:30. Then it was kind of like, you know, I wonder who's phoning at 8:30 on Boxing Day morning. It must be a relative. And I went and answered it. And it was one of my brother's friends. And she was saying, look, have you seen the news? You know, there's this thing in Thailand. I think it's near where they were. And so, of course, you turn on the news and, you know, that's, you know, quite alarming, but equally, you know, of course, the news reports, I think, you know, rightly kind of err on the side of caution in some ways. So, you know, there's sort of these reassuring things that you hear that, you know, the telephones are out, so that's why they haven't phoned. And, you know, and those first numbers are, you know, there's 4 people confirmed dead, you know, and you kind of think, okay, well, that's a tragedy, but that doesn't sound like, you know, there's a likelihood that they're involved. And then, kind of just over the course of, I mean, it wasn't really news. It was, to begin with, it was no news, right? It was just, you know, that you kind of, as the hours tick by and you're kind of thinking, well, you know, we should have heard from them, and you're kind of scouring the internet for any sort of hint, and you're kind of getting rumors on bulletin boards of, you know, people saying, you know, well, I heard the island that they're on is called Phi Phi, and I heard that the island was badly affected, and but, you know, you don't know if that's true. And then we were very lucky that one of my uncles is a, I mean, all my uncles are wonderful, but one of them is a wonderful man who had, you know, traveled in that region quite a lot, and he actually he volunteered to go out and kind of look for them. So in about like a couple of days, like I would imagine it was like the 28th probably, he was on a plane kind of heading out there.
Oh my goodness. And for him, that must have just been like,
I mean it's unimaginable, isn't it? And at that time, you know, we still hoped that, you know, he was going out there to find them, you know, and to find them alive. And as the days tick by, you kind of, you don't lose hope, but I think, you know, you start to have this creeping sense that, you know, this isn't right. And then you start to clutch at the straws of, maybe they have amnesia, you know, maybe they're on a, you know, but the fact was that it was that kind of event. Like, there were so many people involved and so much chaos that those things were sort of conceivable. The numbers were kind of creeping up, like, you know, you'd see the numbers on TV, and, you know, the number that I was focused on was the number of British people, because that kind of, you know, that felt like a surrogate for, you know, what's the level of risk, terms of, and I think there was a point when the 29th or the 30th of December, I was lying awake in bed, and I realized that there had been about 30 names that had been released, and I realized that none of them were from Scotland. And I kind of was just, statistically, I just, you know, I'm a science person by background, and statistically, so that doesn't make sense. You know, there must have been Scottish people involved, and presumably that, you know, that's going to be Dominic and Eileen. And then my uncle in Thailand was kind of giving us regular updates, you know, and he was going around the hospitals and, you know, wasn't finding anyone with amnesia. And what ultimately happened was the process of identifying people was, you know, obviously pretty haphazard for lots of reasons. But they had found a body, and in this pocket of this body's swimming shorts was my brother's wallet. And so that was kind of, you know, that was the real moment when, okay, well, this is, you know, clearly this was Dominic. And, you know, my uncle went to identify him at the, you know, the makeshift hospital, the makeshift morgue. And I think that was genuinely, like, obviously emotionally, I can't imagine how difficult it was, but even in a sort of pragmatic sense, it was difficult because, you know, these people have been in this event and, you know, aren't necessarily, how, you know, they don't necessarily look how they did in life. And so he was sort of, to whatever extent he was able to confirm it was Dominic, but the real thing was, you know, for the bodies to be released, they needed to have sort of DNA and dental records.
So even for them to give you the body, so for them to be like, we're not just going to give it to you because you think it's your son brother.
Yeah, and even though the wallet was there, So which then enters this whole other thing, right? So, you know, I'm thinking about it now for the first time in so long of kind of, you're then like the, you know, the 30th of December, the 31st of December, like I was like calling his dentist and trying to get hold of his dental records to fax them out, and calling the hospital. My brother had he had Crohn's disease, and and he'd had this particular operation, and I remember calling the hospital to try and find out where his scar was located on his abdomen, because that was, you know, that was the kind of detail that that we needed. And the but then
Hard, Simon, to like be trying to like on a, you know, detective hunt to identify a body. Like you always don't want to, you don't want to solve that case, do you?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think for me it really became a sort of like a displacement thing that you know, I'm good at that stuff, at details and calling people and getting to the bottom of things, and you know, that was probably, I concentrated on that, you know, at that point a lot more than, you know, the emotion and like, this is, you know,
you feel, it makes you feel useful, it makes you feel in control, it makes you feel like I'm doing something rather than just sitting here with the truth, which is unbearable.
Exactly. I think control is an interesting, I think maybe, you know, there was a lot of that, just trying to take some sort of control of the situation, even though clearly there was no control to be taken. And so, yeah, the official process, which was, you know, run by a sort of, you know, I think the Thai government, but with a whole consortium of international experts, people had to be identified either by DNA or by the dental records. And the problem with Dominic was we got hold of his dental records, but, you know, there was some technical thing that dental records are just written, you know, they're handwritten, and the British nomenclature differs from the international one. So that wasn't possible. And then you then go down this route of, you know, identifying DNA, which becomes this, you know, again, just this whole incredible procedure of like the, you know, the local police in Edinburgh had to go to their flat and kind of like take their toothbrushes and things.
My God.
And then at the other end, I guess the science is all taking place, but just the scale of the thing, you know, it's a slow moving thing, and it took until the March for like the body to be cleared. Which,
oh my God, the time you must have just, that is such a long time.
Yeah.
I know it isn't in the grand scheme of where you are now, but from Boxing Day to March is a long time to be sort of waiting for. And you can't even have a funeral. You can't even say it's definitely him. Like, was there a tiny part of you? I'm only saying this because I'm sure I would do it, of thinking maybe it's not. Like,
there's absolutely. I mean, there's a huge part of that, and the longer it went on, you know. So my job is, I'm a screenwriter, and so I tell stories for a living, and you know, the idea of this story, like, the structure of it, like, so if you're watching a movie and something's not, like, you know, someone seems to die at the start, but then it's never confirmed, like, you know that at the end of the movie that person
isn't
dead,
right?
Exactly. So I definitely became, as the time went on, sort of kind of secretly more and more convinced that, you know, there had been this terrible error, and it was just a big mistake, and, you know, we were going to find out that they had been washed onto some small island somewhere and were perfectly fine, or were in a, you know, in a hospital with amnesia. I kind of describe those months as suspended animation, because, as you say, like, because you can't have a funeral, it makes it just incredibly difficult to accept it's happened, or even, you know, begin any sort of process of recovery. And I always, you know, have so much love and sympathy for, you know, when I read things in the news about people have gone missing and they don't know what's happened. You know, I think that's just such a uniquely awful, you know, human experience.
Yeah, it's very strange how everything I've read and from talking to people over and over again is that we all know when someone dies, the body is just the body, it's not them. But the body is so important. Like, absolutely. It's so, even though you could be like, it's not who they are. They're, you know, their soul's gone somewhere else, or who they are as a person is, you know, we all have bodies. It's just this thing. But you need that. You need that body. Like, people need, like, the burying of the dead. Like, it's so weirdly fundamental in a way that I think it's quite hard for, like, modern people to get your head around, isn't it? Because there's a part of you that logically thinks, well, why does it matter? And everything I've read is, like, seeing the body is one of the most important things you can do to to help the grief start. Because if you don't see it, there's a part of your brain that's like, maybe they're not, like...
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think it's a really sort of primal, fundamental urge, and it's kind of the last thing you can do for someone, and especially, you know, something like that, when, you know, you mentioned that, you know, they're so far away from home. You know, something happens so far away from home, and you just
want to bring them back.
Exactly. Yeah.
So in March they suddenly get in touch and say
exactly you get a phone call out of the blue that and suddenly and it's all happening very quickly. It's like the body's coming back tomorrow, and so we went out to the airport to meet the body arriving and sort of drove back into town, and obviously the body's in the hearse there, and the undertaker take it into their place, and because of the circumstance, you couldn't see the body. It wasn't, but they have a room in there, don't they? In the undertaker place. And, I definitely spent a long time kind of sitting in there,
Did it feel like, oh, I need to talk to you? Did you feel like, oh, here you're talking to a coffin?
Absolutely. I spent a long time in there, and I just talked, definitely. And because, of course, I think when anyone dies, we all, have this just huge urge to say all the things that, we feel we didn't say. And, I think one of the lessons of my journey has been that at the time, I couldn't believe all these things that I'd left unsaid and all the things that, the further away I get from it, I think, the sort of more fair I can think of things, like the more fairly I can say, well, maybe I didn't exactly say that, but I'm sure he knew that because,
Yeah. Yeah, of course. But I think, I suppose, was it your first major grief, your brother dying? Like, had anything happened?
It was it was far and away. You know, the biggest and the closest. I think it's relevant to mention that, we did have another brother. He was born when I was five, but he was born very unwell. He had, very severe cerebral palsy. He came home from the hospital a few times for visits, but he died at a year old. And I certainly have some memories of that. In terms of actually any sort of processing of grief there was entirely subconscious or unexamined, whereas this was really there, and there were obviously a couple of, I think we all go through life and tangentially there's people that we know that have passed on, but this was the, I think, listening to your show, I think there's always that first big close loss, isn't it? Is the sort of the definitive one.
Definitive is the perfect word for it, because it really does make you go, oh, I didn't say this, or I didn't know I had to say that. I didn't know there was a clock running out. And so that, as we say on the show all the time, we're like, oh, you're in the club, you're not in the club. And I think sometimes I make it sound pretty cool, but it's not. But I think also all you really mean is, oh, I know how fragile things are. That's really what the club is. It's like something got taken from me that was really painful, so now I know how fragile life is. And if you haven't had, like you said, that definitive grief, often you can be like, oh, yeah, I can imagine it's really sad. And you're like, no, it's not sad. Yep. It's terrible. Yep. It's beyond sadness. Yep. So, of course you didn't know to say those things to him because... two brothers, two Scottish brothers. I don't think I'm being fair.
Exactly. I love the way that, I've heard this on the show before where, you talk about it as a club, and I just, I love that terminology because, of course, it's a club that no one would, willingly join. But I felt so strongly in the aftermath and ever since that, there's this very unique bond that, once you've experienced that, you share that bond with every other human that has.
Yeah, I know. And it's sort of, I think I harp on about it because it's sort of the only good thing that you sometimes get of a thing of, like, you go, oh, we're all really connected and we all love people and we all have a similar pain when they go. And sometimes it's helpful to remind yourself how connected we are as humans, because it can be easy to be like, oh, I don't like them, or I don't like their opinion on this, or they don't like this and they're not like me. And then you're like, oh no, we're really all just the same bag of bones walking around to a slightly different heights. That's basically what's going on. So then you talked to him in that room for a long time, and then did you have the funeral quite quickly? I mean, that must have been a very strange to know he'd died in on Boxing Day and then suddenly gathering people, and especially someone young yeah. people funerals are yeah. like packed.
Sure,
like...
absolutely. Yeah. So we did two things, and yeah, I think they both happened fairly quickly. We did there was a sort of, you know, memorial service and a burial that was, you know, really pretty small, like close friends and family. And then I think it was later the same day, I think. We did this celebration of his life, which was, you know, as you say, hundreds of people and, you know, truly a celebration. And I think one of the, for all, I would never relive that horrific time again of not knowing, the one thing about waiting all those months, like, yeah. it really did mean that you kind of knew what you wanted to say, like and
yeah,
all those things unsaid,
yeah.
you know, and I see, you know, when people die and, you know, just people in this tumult of grief having to think, well, what poem would they like or what song would, and, you know, it's impossible. And so we were, you know, we were able to really come together and have this, you know, real genuine celebration.
Yeah, that's so interesting that I've never thought about it from that term, that it, obviously awful, but you did have time to go, I know what I want to stand up and say, and I know what music he wants, and you're not, like you said, you're obviously still in that madness of grief, but you've had some time, which is so rare.
Yeah. And I think it's a particularly sort of, I don't know if it's a particularly British thing or a European thing or a Western thing, for want of a better word, but one of the things that, so I spent a lot of time in Thailand in the aftermath, and one of the things that really struck me was in the Buddhist tradition in that particular area, or at least, you know, amongst the people I knew there, you have this important ceremony at 100 days.
Wow.
And 100 days is this sort of, I think, you know, and I may well be getting this wrong, and, you know, hopefully people can email in and tell me how wrong I've got it. But I think the basic idea is that the 100 days marks a sort of transition of the spirit from being generally around to kind of being somewhere else. And I think that, I don't even know what, if there's statutory bereavement leave in the UK, but, you know, the basic idea seems to be that we have that, you know, someone dies and whoever it is, 5 days later, you're back at work as if nothing happened, you know, and you're supposed to just put it behind you and get on with it and stuff. And I think that that notion of coming together at 100 days or 3 months or, you know, is just, it's really such a beautiful thing. And I wish we had something more like that in our culture that was kind of known.
Yeah, that's lovely, isn't it? That's really nice. I think they've just introduced like 2 weeks statutory bereavement leave. I think it was introduced very initially for like people who'd lost children.
Sure.
And then has now been allowed for like any bereavement, you can claim this leave, which is, but you know, it's 2020 and people are like, oh yeah, I guess it is sad, isn't it, when someone dies. I'm like, yes, it is. I think I might need some time off, but 100 days is really interesting. There's something very solid about that number. And
yeah,
I can completely understand coming back to at that time and being like, yeah, now I want to talk about it again.
Exactly. And I think it's I guess what I love about it is that like it does two things. So it says, we're not forgetting this person. We're going to talk about them. We're going to come together and remember them. But at the same time, it also says, we are going to continue on our grief journey. You know, we're not going to stay lost in this first period of awfulness forever. We're going to carry on, and time is going to alter things.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
When did you go to Thailand? How long did you wait?
It was a while. It was, to begin with, and I beat myself up now actually for quite a few years about that. Like, I didn't go with my uncle at the time, you know, right at the start. And, that was just a practical thing that, you know, my mum was, of course, you know, in bits.
Oh, if I was a mother, I'd be like, you're not going.
Yeah,
like, this sort of like, you're staying here.
Completely. Like, and even actually my uncle, in all the incredible things he did, actually that was one of them, because nobody could say that there wasn't about to be another tsunami. Like, you know, that was a real, a genuine consideration, a genuine risk at that point. So we had the services in March, and then I think that was when I began to think, I really need to go, I need to go. And just kind of partly because it remained a mystery to me. Like, I'd never been to Thailand. I didn't know what it was like there. I didn't know anybody who had been affected by a tsunami. Like, everyone was so kind and thoughtful and supportive. But, you know, if you grew up in Scotland, you maybe read about a tsunami in primary school and a list of, you know, terrible things that can happen to other people elsewhere in the world. But it's not on your radar. So I'd left medicine and I was already working as a screenwriter at that point, and I didn't really work for those first few months. And then I got a job came through in kind of May and June, and I did that job, and then that was when I think that meant I had a bit of money apart from anything else to travel to Thailand. One of my brother's best friends, Neil, was up for coming, and so we went out together. And I think we went, initially we had this big idea that we were going to go and help rebuild the island, because we'd read online that like people were doing that, and of course what they needed was like an out of shape Scottish book person, you know, because that's exactly
oh, you're here with your reading. Fantastic. Excellent. What do you think of Dickens as a Victorian novelist compared with the Georgian work? We need some carpenters and we need some electricians.
Absolutely. So we got there and we found that, you know, first of all, actually, I think a lot of volunteers had been there for months and had actually genuinely contributed, and like but all of that stuff had basically, it certainly hadn't all been sorted out, but like I guess the sort of the basic cleanup,
the immediate, you know,
had been done by, you know, this wonderful group of people that, you know, I'll forever be in awe of. But so Neil and I got there and we found something else. We found a group of people who were building a memorial garden on the island where my brother had been. And we got involved in that. And of course, you know, again, I thought, you know, I'm doing this wonderful thing for the victims of the tsunami. When in fact, clearly what I was doing was working through my own grief.
You can do two things at the same time. Like, I think that's important. We say this on the show all the time, we can get very binary with like, no, this was the thing that was good for the grief, or this was this. And actually, yeah, a memorial garden is hugely important, but it can also help you. Like, sure, they can exist. Both things can be there.
I think that's right. And I think that earlier when you were talking about that club, the club that you go into when you're bereaved, I think, you know, there's lots of terrible things about losing your loved one in a natural disaster or, you know, some kind of mass casualty event that's so public. But one of the things that really, you know, I never really see much spoken about is the sense of family and camaraderie that you end up having with other people that have been through that same experience. So some of the other people involved in building this memorial garden had been through that experience, and some of them lived on the island. They were Australian, some were Thai. You know, there was a sort of group of different people and different experiences. And I should also say there was a lot of incredible volunteers from the UK and the rest of Europe who didn't have a family connection at all and were just, you know, had been, you know, traveling in the region and wanted to come and help out. And, you know, again, that's just a whole other sense of camaraderie and friendship. But in terms of what I was saying earlier about like demystifying the process and understanding what had happened, spending time with people that had, you know, that had lived through it, and also just the simple fact of everybody on that island had, you know, lost not just one person, usually in fact multiple people, and just that that shared experience was such a, you know, such a help to me to hear people.
Yeah,
hear
people. I'm currently writing a book about grief and another club that we can form. Yep. And and I've been writing about the club, and I keep coming back to this thing of like the club has many, many, many rooms. And it's so the comforts that you receive from, and you can visit quite a few, you know, a few. Yeah. So like, you know, I can visit someone in the dad room, but if I find someone in the pancreatic cancer dead room, it's like, oh, wow. And if I find someone in the teenage pancreatic cancer dead club, I'm like, oh, great. Like, and it's this thing about human connection. Like, it's so weird. Like I said, it's so weird, isn't it? And you said so primal. But like when I do speak to someone, you know, and they tick those boxes, for want of better words, I feel like I don't have to explain myself. Yeah. And there's a comfort to that. There's a comfort to going, you know what I mean. And they're like, yeah, I do. And it's not polite. And it's not like, oh, I can imagine. And I guess, yeah, you know, for you, like you said, for something so not random, but so mad and once in a lifetime thing that happens, a natural disaster. I mean, that is, you know, not your everyday experience compared to someone, you know, whose dad died of cancer, which, you know, I can find lots of people who will, you know, have different cancers or different times, but will know what it's like to have a dad die of a terminal illness. So for you, I really understand that need and that comfort of finding other people who are like, yeah, I also lost someone in a tsunami. Like, because I imagine, as you said, in Edinburgh or Glasgow, they were thin on the ground. Sharing your experience.
Yeah, but then I always feel that, like, and again, it's always couched in the, like, none of this is good. You don't want to be in any of these clubs.
Yeah, but it's not cool, guys, but we're making the best. We're making the best.
But I always feel that, like, actually, one of the things about the kind of loss that we experience with Dominic is that, like, firstly, people know about it. The wider community know about it. So, you know, of course, you don't want it to be in the paper. But equally, it means that everyone knows. You don't have to tell everyone what's going on. But also that, you know, I think, you know, one of the toughest things about grief is how lonely it is. And I can imagine if you're a 15-year-old and your dad has passed away, and you're probably the only person in your school, or one of three people in your school, or whatever that is. Whereas I, as soon as I got to Thailand, immediately found an entire community of people like me.
And did you really feel that when you got to the island? Did you feel like, how did it feel? Did your shoulders kind of drop? Were you like, oh, okay, they get it? Or was it just...
No, I mean, it was tough to start with because, you know, it's too hot and, you know, there's mosquitoes and, you know, we were doing basically manual labor, which I'm not built for. So lots of those challenges. And we were only supposed to be there for 2 weeks because we were going to rebuild the island in 2 weeks, right? That was
great. Take about three tops.
For sure. And so after, you know, when we came to, it was only like, you know, 2 days before we were supposed to go go home, that you know, and Neil had to go home because he had a job that he had to go back to, and I suddenly said to Neil, you know, I'm thinking I might stay on a bit longer. You know, I think this might be, and of course he was very supportive, and so I did. But it definitely, I think it took a couple of weeks to really get into this ring of things, and even, you know, the people that I became very close to, I think we still all have our, you know, we're all quite reserved as humans a lot of the time, and so it's not like, you know, it's not necessarily that you meet and immediately you're into the deep stuff.
No, that's true. Yes, that's how I work. it's always quite intense quite quickly. So how long did you stay for?
So I went for a month, and then I went back to Edinburgh for a couple of weeks, and then I came back bringing my mum.
How was that?
I wish I'd asked her before I came on, because as I remember it, I think it was great. I think it was a really important step on our journey together, and I wanted her to... she'd been to Thailand before, so it wasn't, you know, she was probably better traveled than me, in fact, and so it wasn't sort of, it wasn't like a fish out of water kind of comedy. She was kind of okay at that. But I think, you know, I wanted her to kind of meet the people that I had met and kind of understand things through the prism that, you know, that I had come to. And I think, you know, I think for her, actually, I think I remember her saying this. I think she's, I remember her saying something like, that was all great, but actually the bit I liked was spending time with you. So I think, you know, we probably could have gone to Devon for a similar experience.
Did you go to the beach? Like, did you sort of go visit?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big part of, you know, I'm a, you know, as I said, I was a doctor, so I'm essentially a scientist in my brain, you know, and I'm a detailed person. So I want to know and I want to understand things. One of the big misconceptions I had was, you know, just the physicality of it. That, you know, I remember one of the things we hung on to at the time was Dominic is 27 and he's a, you know, he's strong and he's a good swimmer. So, you know, how can a wave actually cause that problem? And so, but one of the things that I learned from the experience was, you know, I learned a bit about tsunami and, you know, the description of a wave is kind of, it's kind of the wrong metaphor because it is a wave, but, you know, to go into the physics of it, it's a wave with a 20-mile long period. So basically it's, if you're standing on the beach, it's not that there's a wave, it's that there's a River Thames there suddenly that wasn't there before.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that is a very different picture, isn't it? Because I'm the same as you, or you sort of imagine a massive wave, but yeah, it's not as simple as that.
No, exactly. And so I think being there helped me to understand the geography of it, because I think from the news reports, I had this sense of, like, you know, there was terrible bad luck to be there in the first place. And then there's also terrible bad luck because, you know, you hear all these miracle stories of, like, people surviving by climbing on a roof or hanging on a tree or something. But actually being there and kind of being taken around and showing things by the people that lived there, you know, you very quickly come to understand that really no one survived where they were. Like, they were just in the worst place. And you understand that there's some unique geography about that island, that it's not at its highest point on the main bit where the town is. It's only about 20 feet above sea level. And the way the bay is shaped kind of, like, funnels water in. So we went and we kind of, one of the Thai people I became friendly with had worked at the place where my brother was staying, and he was kind of able to identify for us, like, to the spot where their bungalow had been. And so when my mum came out, we went and we did, like, a little ceremony there. You know, we lit some candles and listened to some Bob Marley, which is what my brother loved. So I don't know. I know that some people, when they lose someone, that's the very last thing that they want to do. And I know people, you know, that I know through the tsunami, that's been their way of grieving, is, you know, they don't want anything to do with it and they would never dream of going to Thailand or anything like that. But yeah, I was very much the opposite. I needed to kind of go and understand it. And then this wonderful thing happened where my brother really liked Thailand. Like, he'd been there a few times and, you know, he was always telling me to go. And I never kind of wanted to, because I was always kind of like a fussy traveller, you know, and I sort of was like, well, you know, will there be enough air conditioning? Am I going to be able to, like, how am I going to get from the airport to the hotel? What do you mean there isn't a hotel? Where will I sleep? What will I eat? You know, I guess I've spoken of it sometimes as this kind of Thailand being this last, you know, this last incredible gift that my brother gave me, because I kept going.
And when did you start? Because you wrote the book about it in 2011. Well, it came out in 2011.
Yeah.
When did you start? Because, as you said, you're already a screenwriter, and we talk about this on the show all the time. I'm obsessed with the narrative of a death and how that can change how you feel about it and how important it is to have a hold of that narrative. Like, so you see yourself in that narrative. So when did you start thinking, I need to write about this? Like, when did that happen?
To begin with, I was absolutely adamant that I was never going to write about it. And it was such a, I didn't feel entitled to, you know, I felt it was this sacred thing and that, you know, I didn't want in any way to be taking advantage of it or capitalizing on it, because of course, in some way, as a writer, you know, you can kind of see there's a book there, right? But I genuinely didn't. And what happened was, so I'd been kind of working on the peripheries of TV screenwriting for a while, by which I mean, you know, I got sort of reasonably steady work, kind of like some rewriting things, some, you know, writing pilots that never went anywhere. And, you know, it wasn't, you're nodding, probably, yep.
We've all been there. That fun job.
And it wasn't the glory days of British television, and it wasn't the glory days of my television writing. So, you know, in a way, it's probably good that none of them went anywhere. But something happened that I guess the kind of work I was doing was like kind of like gentle, lighthearted, warm comedies, because partly that was what ITV showed in 2004. I'd kind of got to this point where, you know, people kind of liked what I did, and I'd, you know, been cunningly maneuvering myself for a couple of years into a position where it was probably time to kind of write my own show, and everyone was ready to receive this gentle, warm comedy from me. And of course, everything I found myself writing was ostensibly a gentle, warm comedy, but it was always about someone dying or someone's brother dying or like a mass catastrophe, you know. And
it leaks out of you, doesn't it? It leaks out. And you're this is so, what am I writing? And you're like, but I can't write anything else, because that's the grief. The grief is just, I remember, as I've said before, like when I started doing character stand-up and like everything was so bleak and about grief, but like wrapped up in this character. And I'd think, what? Come on, try and write something light. Come on, you can do it. And it was like, no, because you're just in that bit of your grief, and it just, there's no choice, really.
Absolutely. And so, and I think it was really difficult for the people I worked with, because, of course, they wanted to support me because I'd just been through this horrific thing. But, you know, the thing I wrote, you know, they couldn't show it on ITV. It was a sitcom set in the afterlife. And, of course, now sitcoms set in the afterlife are all the rage.
But,
you know, 2004 was just too early for that. So I didn't want to write about it. It was frankly ruining my screenwriting. But also this thing happened where I didn't, I think as many people do when they lose someone, I reevaluated my priorities and what I was doing in life. And, you know, I had trained as a doctor, and the reason I'd become a writer, I'd taken 6 months out to write my great book of literary short stories, because what the world had needed was a great book of literary short stories by me when I was 24. And thankfully they didn't, and no one published it. You know, and we wouldn't be here talking today probably if they did. And of course, after the tsunami and the year in Thailand, I felt, what am I doing with myself? I'm going to go back to medicine. So I went back to medicine, and that was, you know, frankly, such a relief, because I was always quite envious of people I knew that when they lost someone still had sort of structure and routine, because as you know, as a sort of freelance person, a freelance creative person, it's very easy to sit all day thinking about yourself, and that's not necessarily great at a time of grief. I went back to medicine, and almost as a, like I describe it as a creative exorcism, that like I was never, you know, it was never for publication, but I knew I kind of just had to get this stuff out, because it was, you know, it was colouring everything I tried to write. And I'd begun to realise that, like, I was already forgetting, like, things about my brother, and I was forgetting sort of specific memories. And so I decided I was going to start writing about it, and it was just for me, and it was never for publication. And of course I started writing, and it just came, you know, flowing out, and, you know, I just couldn't stop writing about it for a long time. And eventually I kind of showed it to a friend, and they said, well, you know, I'm really moved by it, but also, have you thought about publishing it? And I said, no, it's not for publication. But of course, with hindsight, what was I doing showing it to my friend if it, for some, you know, I'm sure there was some devious part of my subconscious that was saying, well, show it to your friend, and if they want it to get, you know, if they say you should get it published, then who are you to stand in their way?
But also, I think that, you know, you're a writer, and you can write something just for yourself. And I think that's often the best way to start a project, is to trick your brain, this is just for me, and then you take the pressure off. But writers write to be read. They don't write for things to go into drawers. So of course, you know, once you've done it, you start thinking, well, it's not bad, is it? It's quite, someone should read it. Like, there's nothing wrong with that at all. I think that's like in your DNA. So yeah, so then you wrote it, and obviously it became very successful. I just wondering, we talked about this on the show a lot as well, of like the weirdness of success that comes from something so painful. Like, sure. How did you sort of manage that kind of weird, like, oh, that's great, but is it because I wrote it because my brother died?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was definitely like a very bittersweet experience, you know? I mean, I think what really made it great for me was that it meant that I got to talk about him, because, you know, one of the things about grief is, you know, everyone's always very kind, but, you know, naturally people move on, and people have their own lives to deal with. And, you know, again, much like the 100 Days ceremony, you know, the book was published in 2011, and we'd lost them in, you know, the end of 2004. So the idea that 6 years later we could come together and talk about them, and I got to do a, you know, we're from Edinburgh, and I got to talk at the Edinburgh Book Festival, and, you know, the audience was just filled with, you know, our friends and family, and it was, you know, probably basically all the same people that had been at the celebration, right? The memorial service. That was a real privilege. There was someone, I think it was like in the Telegraph, like one of the reviews said this lovely thing where it sort of said something like, you know, Simon Stevenson probably feels guilty that, you know, he has this story to tell and he probably feels guilty for telling it, but he shouldn't because, you know, he's told it in the right way or something. And that really meant the world to me. You know that was a very generous comment from someone who didn't need to do that. But then I think the other sort of interesting bit of it is that was 2011, and you know my plan then was then I was a real writer. I was a grown up writer because I'd published a memoir, and that was what serious writers do. And it had been on Radio 4, and therefore you know I had my membership card to the Fancy Writers Club. And what that then meant was that you know I had to write a novel because that was what grown up writers do. And I couldn't. I quit my job to write a novel, and I you know started 5 or 6 novels, and none of them got past about 10,000 words. And with hindsight, the problem was that the book about my brother had just, it felt, you know, already with hindsight in 2011, it felt like it was kind of the only story I would ever have to tell that was worth telling, you know, because it was such a big thing and it was true and it was important. And then the idea that I would now just go and make something up and that would be as, you know, as important to me or worth anyone reading was just, that felt like quite an alien thought. So I guess the other part to writing about that stuff is that it did ruin that kind of writing for me for quite a long time afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I can really relate to that. I think it's interesting when you are someone who talks about your grief publicly, and there's two truths, and one of the truths is it's wonderful because you get to talk about it and everyone knows your story, so everyone's very sensitive because everyone's like, oh no, I know exactly what happened to them. So you never have to be in a situation where you're like, don't make that joke, like, sure, this happened to me. Everybody knows, so that's really nice. It's like, yeah, it colors a lot of your life. It's very sad, you're kind of in sadness a lot. And then I totally relate to when you've written about something so truthful and so from the heart, really, really from the heart, that the next thing that you're like, I mean, I find out when I go back to writing comedy and you're like, oh, something stupid happened. You're like, oh, really? Really, life, does it? Like they fall over and then they suddenly realize we're all going to die. it's hard, isn't it? It's hard. But I think it sounds like, well, you know, you do have a new book coming out and it sounds like you found your way through that. I guess it's just patience, isn't it? It's like not just allowing, going, hey, this is all part of the grief journey. Of course the next book isn't going to just pop out easily. It's going to take time for your heart to kind of reform from that, you know, you exposing it so truthfully.
Absolutely. I think completely that, you know, I think for so many of us, that's just the resounding lesson of these experiences, isn't it? Is that things happen on their own time. You know, and it was interesting what you were saying there about talking about your story and everyone knowing your story. Because I almost find, and you mentioned about them, you know, someone makes a joke and it's, you know, it's a tough one. And it's almost like, it for me anyway, it's not that I'm insulted about it. It's just that when I then tell them what's happened, then they're going to feel awful. And that's like this whole other thing, right? But one of the problems I have with actually talking about that book is that, you know, it was published 5 years after the event. So it's tremendously sad in the beginning, but it's also quite funny in places. I mean, you know, and I can say that because people have told me it's quite funny in places. And, you know, I get sort of, you know, people sort of saying, you know, oh, you know, I'm reading your book, it's so sad. And I say, well, keep going, it gets funny. You know?
I know, that's like with the podcast, I'm constantly like, yeah, it's about my dad dying, but it's cheerier than it sounds. Yeah. Like, it's actually, some of the episodes are like actually really funny. And then you're like, Carrie, don't over push the comedy. Like, sure, it is also about death, because then you can see they look at you like, wow, they really haven't dealt with that, have they? Like, they're now making constant jokes. You're like, no, it's not, I'm more adjusted than I'm making it sound.
Yeah. And the phrase you used there, it's cheerier than it sounds. I mean, that's the phrase I use like all the time. That's the endless one when I describe
that's
that book.
Literally like, yeah, on the like press release for Griefcast. Oh, brilliant. It's just wonderful. Like, as soon as people say, as soon as like, oh, I do a podcast about death. You know, I have kids now, and so you have that sort of playground chat And it's a very like, oh, I do this podcast about death and their faces. I'm like, it's cheerier than it sounds. It's actually with comedians. And then they kind of relax. They're like, oh, okay. Because for me, they're like, oh God, am I going to have like a really depressing conversation with you? And it's,
sure.
Yeah, it's that joy of the club, I guess, isn't it? Of knowing, oh no, we can use humor and it doesn't mean we didn't love and really miss that person. Like,
absolutely.
How are you feeling about it now as you approach 16 years? Is it starting to move into a different phase, or it's still very painful? Or
I don't think it's still very painful. I mean, obviously, you know, I think you miss your loved people forever, but I definitely feel like, and whether, you know, I think the big part of it is time. I remember in the midst of it, one of my uncles saying, you know, it won't always feel this way, you know, you'll reach a point where you can think of him and be happy about him. And I just remember thinking, well, I love you, but that's absolutely ridiculous. That's never going to happen. And genuinely, you know, I am at that point, and I think I've been here for, you know, quite some time. The main feeling I have is just, you know, I feel bad for them, just for, you know, the fact that they didn't get to, you know, have all these years of life, which I'm enjoying. And, you know, I'm out here, you know, having this great adventure in California, and, you know, my brother didn't ever get to come to California, you know, and I, you know, he would have loved it. And so that stuff remains really tough, but it's not sort of, you know, the agony of the early months or the early years. And if, you know, I look back and I think, you know, probably if you'd asked me year two or year three, I would have said, oh, I'm doing fine. You know, yeah. And actually it's only when you look back and you go, wow, no, that was still it. So maybe in 10 years I'll look back and go, wow, after only 16 years, I really was just, you know, at the beginning of the journey.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Because I think the weird thing is, if, at any point, if you, because I'm 20 plus years now, you think if someone had asked me at that time, I would have gone, no, you know what? Like, I'm sort of okay. Like, apart from obviously year one, two, I think, where you're just insane and deeply, deeply, you know, upset all the time. But yeah, I would have thought to myself, oh yeah, I'm okay. And then you look back, God, I don't think I was okay in year five, actually, was I? Like, I was doing lots of weird things. Like, but that's, you know, also that's life. Also, that's not always connected to them, but also sometimes it is. And it's important, I guess, as you said, to just allow it to be. And I am now that uncle. Like, I speak to people who are year one and two, and I'm like, I promise you, it's going to change. And I see them looking at me like, fuck you. And I'm like, I know, but like, we have this joke on another episode with the writer, Perna Bell. And we were calling ourselves like grief elders. Like, you feel like the one in the village that's like, you know, trust me. And it's really hard, because when you are in the beginning, when someone says that to you, you're like, I can't conceive of not finding this so painful. I can't even speak about it. And that's what people mean by time, like when they say time heals. And it's such a shit, it's a shit phrase, because it needs to be longer. Like, it needs to be, time will afford you a perspective to realize that, you know, you love them, you miss them, but also your life has moved on, and that will feel a healing process, like, which, you know, doesn't make for a great card. So
No, for sure. But
I understand.
I think that's exactly right, is that, healing is very complex, and as you say, isn't just a single word.
Simon, thank you so much. It was so brilliant to talk to you, like, and to hear about Dominic and your journey with that. I just think, what an incredible, and I hate to say it because it sounds like an incredible story. It is an incredible story. And to share Dominic with us in that way, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for, you know, the work that you do, because I think it really is so genuinely, you know, important to bring people together to share this journey. I think it's incredible. So thank you.
You can follow Simon on Twitter at TheSimonBot, B-O-T. His book, Set My Heart to Five, is out in paperback in the new year, but obviously it's available in hardback now. And Let Not the Waves of the Sea is also available to buy from all good bookshops. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. The show was edited by Kate Holland. Artwork was by Jade Perkin. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.